I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's good to have you with us today. A lot happened over the weekend, and we start today with reaction to that alleged chemical attack in Syria on Saturday night. It's one of those moments that feels like it could change the direction of the conflict, and we are hearing from several people, including President Trump, that there will be a strong response. But there have been other moments like this before in Syria. There was President Obama's red line warning after a previous chemical attack, which led to some chemical weapons being seized from Syria, but not much change in the direction of the war.
Russians, the French, the Brits, the Americans, the Syrians have been let alone so that the country is destroyed. Even the Security Council, they didn't succeed. Nothing has been solved. Nothing has been done. The killing is going on and on.
That's a Syrian journalist in Damascus, but many other people who've closely followed this conflict might express the same kind of frustration. In a few minutes, the big picture of the war in Syria, but let's find out first what happened this weekend in Douma, which is in the eastern Ghouta area near Damascus. The World's Richard Hall has been following the story from his base in Beirut and speaking with people on the ground in Syria.
The offensive in eastern Ghouta has been going on since early February. And Douma is kind of the last holdout in Ghouta. It's the last town held by the rebels. And the Syrian government has been bombarding Douma for 3 days before Saturday. Conventional weapons, shells, airstrikes. Then at around 9:45 p.m. on Saturday evening, a different kind of attack began. People started flooding into medical centers showing signs of gas poisoning. And some really awful, terrible videos emerged showing some of the victims of that attack.
And do we know how many people were injured and how many people were killed at this point?
So we have rough numbers at the moment. The Syrian civil defense, the White Helmets, say around 500 people were treated. They counted 46 people killed, but they said there were many more. They had to stop searching because of the fumes. They could still smell the fumes. And I actually spoke to a medical student named Mohammed, who was working in a medical center when the attack happened in Douma. And he told me that he'd already been working for 3 days nonstop when the chemical attack happened.
We tried to save them, but a lot of the poison couldn't be treated because the White Helmet teams couldn't reach them and save them. They died in their homes.
So as you can hear, he's completely overwhelmed. Mohammed is completely overwhelmed. They were working for 3 days before that attack happened. He said that patients were showing all these symptoms associated with chemical attacks.
The persons who was accepted in the hospital were suffering from symptoms of dilated bubbles and coughing blood from their mouth. There were a foam in their mouth. They were in a bad neural state.
Can you just give us a little context about what's been going on in Douma, specifically over the past few weeks? Like, why did the Syrian government use gas after weeks of airstrikes?
So, yeah, this is a question that many people have been asking today. Why would the Syrian government use gas when it appears to be winning? So what's been happening in Douma is that there has been one rebel group called Jaish al-Islam, and they have been holding out in Ghouta and in Douma for a long, long time. There were negotiations going on between the Russian military and Jaish al-Islam for them to remain in Douma. This is what's been reported by Reuters. And apparently the Syrian government was very unhappy about that arrangement. And according to some analysts, they sought to thwart that arrangement by essentially terrifying civilians and forcing Jaish al-Islam out. And if that was indeed the case, it seems to have worked because Jaish al-Islam agreed today to surrender and withdraw from Douma.
Yeah, but it worked at what appears to be a very steep price for civilians. President Trump has hinted that he was considering a military response with a tweet that pointed the finger at Russia and Iran. I mean, this after he kind of prematurely said the U.S. is going to withdraw from Syria last week. Is there a chance U.S. policy in Syria may change?
I don't think so. And some of the people I've been talking to think the same. The U.S. is kind of walking a very thin line. People are saying that the U.S. is likely to come up with some sort of military response to punish Assad without escalating the conflict. So that might just be some sort of symbolic strikes. It might be a repeat of what we saw last year after the attack in Khan Sheikhoun, where the U.S. cratered a runway at an airbase. And after that, everyone just kind of went about their business again and nothing really happened. And chemical attacks continued.
What happens now to the people of Douma, Rich? Where are they going to go? And do they think they're safe now that this group, Jaish al-Islam, is gone?
What's happening in Douma now is that there are around 100 buses waiting to escort Jaish al-Islam fighters and their families out. And of course, like has happened many times previously, many civilians will choose to leave as well because they fear reprisals from the Syrian government. We saw this in Aleppo. We saw this in other parts of Ghouta as well. I spoke to one resident who was leaving tomorrow, and this is what he told me.
It's a feeling of frustration. I'm leaving the city I grew up in, and I'm afraid that I probably won't be able to get back to the city. Because once the regime takes control of the area, all of the acts of violation of human rights and all of the acts that came from the dictatorship will happen again.
So many Syrians forced from their homes, Rich. I mean, it's really extraordinary. And here are Syrians who don't want to leave, and they too have to go.
That's right, yeah. And we should, of course, be thinking about what comes next for these people. This has happened to thousands upon thousands of people, civilians, who have chosen to leave their homes in Aleppo and these other places where the Syrian government has taken back control from rebels. They're being sent to Idlib, which is really the last major rebel stronghold. All indications suggest that there is going to be an equally brutal campaign to regain that part of the country, and that these same civilians will be in the firing line again, and they'll be forced to face the same airstrikes and the same attacks all over again.
The world's Rich Hall in Beirut. Thanks very much, Rich.
Thanks, Marco.
Chemical attack over the weekend and Trump's tweet about it gave you a feeling of deja vu. You now understand why. Rich was referring to a sarin gas attack a year ago last week that killed more than 80 people in Syria in Khan Sheikhoun. Trump said at the time that had crossed many, many lines, and he then ordered an airstrike on a Syrian military base. Politico's Susan Glasser wrote about that at the time and about what some saw as the Trump administration's whiplash-inducing isolationism and hawkishness. Susan Glasser joins us now from Washington. She is Politico's chief international affairs columnist and the host of the podcast, The Global Politico. Susan, do you see some consistency with Trump's position on Syria today with what we've seen in the past?
Right. Consistently inconsistent. That's pretty much the story here. It is amazing that it was basically exactly 1 year ago we were having the same conversation. Would Trump strike at Syria in response to a chemical weapons attack? And if so, which he ultimately did, what would it mean in terms of his Syria policy? And I think what happened last year gives us a guide to what we might expect this time, which is to say genuine outrage on the part of the president. Clearly, he as I'm sure with many of your listeners, is looking at those photographs, reacting to them, saying this is unacceptable. He's promised a response now within 24 to 48 hours. But, you know, my view is that even if a strike of some kind is likely, which it probably is right now, this is still the same president who just 5 days ago said we need to get out of Syria right now, notwithstanding the policy of continuing to stay there after the defeat of the Islamic State that he had agreed to with his own advisors just a few months ago.
Now, in that article you wrote for Politico a year ago, you wrote that there was one consistent thread through Trump's apparent foreign policy contradictions, and that was being the not Obama. Do you see more of that today?
Yes, I think not Obama is still a pretty good guide to at least how President Trump wants to see himself on foreign policy. In fact, he, over the weekend, when tweeting about Syria, specifically mentioned President Obama again. The connection with the current situation in the Red Line is a little bit obscure, since Trump himself last year said that chemical weapons used by Assad would not stand. And in fact, now Assad has repeated it all over again. But certainly, Trump wants to be seen in the world as acting in a way that he believes Barack Obama would not.
So last year, Trump said there was a red line, Assad crossed, and then Trump had the airstrikes on that base in Syria. When he refers to this red line that Obama set up on using chemical weapons, does that criticism force Trump now into a place where he has to respond?
Well, it certainly makes it likelier that Trump would respond. But of all recent presidents, one thing that is remarkable about Trump is that he doesn't seem to mind being called a hypocrite or inconsistent in his policy. Other presidents, as you know, had a sort of abhorrence of that, and it made some of their actions more predictable. I would say that Trump is less vulnerable to that charge. However, I would note that the point foreign policy experts have when they use the term red line is that it's meant to signal in international relations an unacceptable move that will trigger future consequences. And to the extent that Donald Trump drew a red line himself last year around the use of chemical weapons by the Assad government, well, they've now felt free to cross that not once but twice. So last year's retaliatory strike did not have the intended effect. And basically, the Assad regime has said to Donald Trump, just as it said to Barack Obama, we don't care about your red line. The United States of America can't stop us from doing this. And the indications are that that's correct, which really suggests that the diminution of American power in the Middle East, regardless of what Trump chooses to do now.
So Trump has come out now and blamed Assad and also Russia and Iran. How do you read this? I can only describe it as a more clear-eyed assessment of world affairs from the president, especially after his pulling punches with Putin and that very slow response to what appeared to be Russia poisoning a former double agent in the UK. I mean, what do you see here?
Well, I think on the one hand, it's always good, in my view, whether you're the president or anybody else, to be as clear-eyed as possible about what's actually going on in the world. And it is, as they would say, a true fact that both Russia and Iran have propped up, enabled, and boosted the Assad government in Syria throughout this long and horrible civil war, 7 years already and counting. So, you know, on one hand, it's just a statement of fact. What it's not, however, is a statement of policy. There's an implicit threat embedded in that Trump tweet, but it's not clear what kind of a threat it is, first of all. Second of all, what I'm struck by is more than a year into the Trump administration, there's just enormous confusion about what his policy towards Syria is and more broadly in the Middle East. And of course, on some level, you need to be clear about your policy for even your own side to carry it out. And, you know, you just had a situation last week where Trump has undercut what his top officials believed to be their policy in Syria, which was staying there. And in fact, actually, at the moment Trump was saying he wanted to consider immediately withdrawing from Syria, you had the head of CENTCOM, General Votel, at that exact same moment at the U.S. Institute for Peace, talking about the American commitment to remain behind and to work on reconstruction and to finish the job against the Islamic State. And so, you know, who do you believe? The head of CENTCOM, whose job it is to have thousands of soldiers in the field and to carry out a strategy, or the commander-in-chief who says, well, maybe I don't support that strategy that I already signed off on?
So, Susan, on day one of John Bolton as Trump's national security advisor, what thoughts occur to you about where all this could lead in Syria if this hawk now has Trump's ear?
Well, that's right. It is. It would be a huge and resonant irony, wouldn't it, if the very hawkish John Bolton, the new national security advisor, if his first 24 hours in office, the United States was actually bombing a country. Bolton is almost cartoonishly famous for advocating bombing strikes against a variety of countries, not just in Syria, which he did advocate last year, but also he's publicly advocated in recent months military attacks on both Iran and North Korea.
Susan Glasser, Politico's chief international affairs columnist in Washington. Thanks for being with us, as always.
Thank you so much for having me.